So over here in Europe, across the Atlantic, do y'all have Halloween?
Not so much. I mean,
No?
there. Okay, so there's a thing there, really, because there's kind of traditional Halloween, and there's, if you don't mind me saying, American Halloween.
Oh, I'm all about it. No
Yeah,
problem. Yeah.
So traditional Halloween is basically the Wicker Man, you know,
Oh
the
yeah.
Wicker Man,
Nicolas
and
Cage.
in a cage, and all that. An American, I can't say this is a terrible thing. It's true though. American Halloween is basically anything that costs money. So some, if someone's making money out of it, it's new Halloween. Old Halloween is wondering if your neighbor is a witch, being happy your neighbor is a witch, going to, you know, dance around something naked, that kind of stuff, like proper Halloween. And people do that. People go up onto, in fact, I know someone who does this, who, it goes up onto the side of a not big mountain, but a mountain nonetheless, and dances around with no clothes on at some solstice or something.
I know, but what do they do during Halloween? Am I right?
Look,
Man.
I'm yeah. So we kind of do, but I would really like to resurrect, if you'll pardon the word, a Halloween which is, you know, genuinely terrifying and people really worry about, rather than, you know, egging someone and trick or treat and that kind of stuff.
Well, first of all, I mean, your characterization is fine, right? Like, I mean, we are a nation of merchants. So, what are you gonna do?
Probably.
Gotta make that, gotta get that paper, as they say, the people with stuff on their dresser. So, sure, that's no problem. Now, it also reminds me of Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead to butcher it, which is, I think, is somewhere in between there, right? Like, you got this idea that ghosts actually are resurrected, but it's kind of cool, right? It's not scary. And then also, I mean, I'm sure they have like candy. Although, have you ever been to a Mexican bakery? I don't know if I.
I've only been to a Mexican pharmacy.
Oh, yes. I don't know if I've covered this recently, but Mexican bakeries, their stuff is not very good. Like, at least the ones we have in Austin that I've been to. And here's my problem, and then I don't want to like dig myself into a an arroyo, as they might say, but like, you go in there, and I don't eat sweets very much, right? So if I'm gonna eat a sweet, I want it to be like top notch, right? And you go in there and you order a sweet and it looks good and you're eating it, and I always want to go up to the counter and say like, "Oh, hey, did the chef forget to put sugar in here?" Because they just, I don't know what it is. They're just not very good.
Dough.
I don't know. I don't know. But I would love, because I would love to find a high quality, or not even high quality, a Mexican bakery that met my standards of sweetness. Because I think visually, a Mexican bakery is the most visually appealing, like, of all pastry shops, right? It's just like, just full of stuff. And it'd be great if they tasted good. Now, related to the nation of merchants, I've been thinking about this a lot here in Amsterdam. I read two books, History of Amsterdam books, because I figured I should do that, because
Don't want to look like a chump.
no. And it's what's kind of a the reverse chump move is, I've talked to several, well, they're not all Amsterdammers, but Dutch people, and I'll start going over the history, and they're like, I've never heard that. So,
Let me just stop you there. I don't care. I don't care about the canals. Don't tell me about
No, they don't even cover
the
that. They don't even cover that. But I mean, it's sort of covered, but not that much. But what I realized is that it's not all of the Netherlands, because they used to be kind of separate-y kind of things. But Amsterdam has always been like a merchant city. It's basically the whole mentality is like merchants. Even like the founding, not the founding, but I don't know, oldest, most important thing in the history books is like, I won't tell the whole story, but it became like a, what do you call it? like a Catholic relic site that people would take pilgrimages to, which is like a
Oh, I see.
moneymaker, right? Like it was one of the top five places in
Yeah.
Europe in like 12 Lonely Planet's 1200s guide to Europe. Rick Steves through the medieval back door. And
Medieval Europe won't grow today.
yeah, so it helped establish it and bring money in. But in contrast to it's interesting to contrast the American mercantile people as characterized. I don't know what the answer is, but I'll probably be thinking about it versus the Amsterdamer mercantilism, because they're both like the end goal is the same. It's just like make that money by like trading stuff. And but they're different I don't know. The outside is different.
Yeah. I think there's also that the there's also been that tension between business as a way of making money and getting out, what's your exit kind of stuff, and business as a way of being in business.
A
So,
lifestyle, as it
yeah,
were.
lifestyle. And in the past, you had this idea of being in trade. So if in the 1700s, 1800s, if you'd inherited wealth, then you were like upper class. If you had to work for money, you were like some artisan. They weren't proper, nice people, but upper class people. But now it's interesting because there's a lot of there is that drive to, I want to go into business. What business? Oh, just business.
The
Some business. Some business. And then it's straight into, growth hacking and all that kind of stuff. Make money and move on. And it feels like, to me, it always feels like, all right, I kind of accept if an organization, a company is going to make a huge amount of money if they're doing big stuff. If you're doing big stuff, if you're selling a lot of stuff to people, or you're selling a very high value thing, then it seems to make sense that you're making a lot of money. As long as, but that's probably a really old fashioned view of I can see how these people are making money, but now, yeah, it's less evident, I think.
And then of course, I mean, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that the British, of course, famous merchants through the centuries.
Yes, nation of shopkeepers.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, just, that was another realization that I had in reading these histories that it's reflected on all empires is basically there's this intertwining in all Western empires. I don't know about Eastern ones of corporations and the
Yes,
military.
yes, yes.
It,
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
it,
yeah.
it, they basically go hand in hand that you build a as we would say nowadays a global 2000 business, so an international business by having a military. Like that's
Yeah.
pretty much how it's done.
And things like the East India Company for the Brits, and privateers, and letters of marque, where you could basically be a kind of licensed pirate on behalf of the monarch. That view of private and public enterprise really has changed, and I suppose in a way continues to change now that God, what was I reading? That one of those I think you might have pointed to it, the Air Force thing
Right.
with the making a big public organization behave in a particular way. And I love the idea of, yeah, we're not wearing our uniforms. We've put on these other uniforms in a way to make us think
That's
in
right.
a different way. They were. It was really strange. It was a
Yeah,
weird idea.
that's true.
Very interesting, though.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting little tidbits in those
Yes.
stories. That's
Yeah.
a you know at a meta level, when I was looking through all this Air Force stuff last week, and just as background, so like at Pivotal, the Air Force, I mean, as we used to joke about when we were an analyst, the military is a customer of everyone, so whatever. But the US Air Force has done some work with Pivotal, and they've also talked a lot about it, which is very rare for militaries. But so there's about, let's say, four main recorded presentations that they've done that are out on YouTube. And then there are probably five articles that have been written relevant to this. And then there's some ancillary things. But it was an interesting exercise of like finding all that stuff and like boiling, first comprehending it all. And then also like, I remember I used several sources to piece together a timeline of all the projects they worked on. And it is like an interesting exercise to think about. You got all this content out there, but you have to like pull it together into a narrative and a story.
Yes.
Yeah. And it also feels like you also have to be really careful because it's like a customer of the company I work for. And then also the military. So you can't like reveal any secrets. So everything has to be like traced back to some public source somewhere, which is, I don't know. I remember when I was first like writing up that story, there was a like 2.5 hour Facebook video that was like a recording of some event.
Yeah.
And I had to like scrub through that a lot to find all these figures, which is, I mean, it's like the internet's a strange place.
So then you have a public, you have a published.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
That's right. Okay. That's right. Because of course you can't reveal things they don't want you to reveal, that any customer wants you to, right? So you have to like get something on public on the record in order to be able to like ethically and also you'd like to stay employed, talk about it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But it's fun. You piece together all that stuff.
Yeah. Do you remember there was that whole thing, maybe it still happens, about open source intelligence?
No. Is there intelligence in open source?
Oh, well, this is the thing. It's not open source about... No, it's not intelligence about open source. It's a yet another misuse of the term. The idea that you can actually go onto the internet and search for things and find them.
Oh, right.
So if you wanted to know, you know, has South Korea built another, submarine, you could just do some searching around in some procurement records that they'd released, and then you'd find out. And that it's interesting that it seems to in a really clunky way that it comes back to that. I think it was either Clay Shirky, probably Clay Shirky thing, where, or maybe it was Cory Doctorow. I can never remember that thing of it's not a question of too much information. It's in ineffective filters or ineffective aggregation, because a lot of people, and I find this particularly talking about. And you can hear the air quotes here, open data or open APIs, which almost seem to be a thing of the past now, of talking about that stuff to people and them nodding. And then they leave the room. And I think I haven't communicated this well enough for them to be happy about paying money for this. You know, it's like, oh, open source and open data, and we've got these APIs which allow you to do this and the other. Nod, nod, nod. Thanks. Great.
Mm-hmm.
Done.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Mm. But that's the same kind of thing, in that quite often my crude way of describing it is what certain people want is pixels on the screen. And if you can show pixels on the screen, then you've got a sale, you've got a way in. But if you're still talking about APIs and JSON and that kind of stuff, it's like, look, I don't know what you're talking about, man, which is legit. You know, I don't expect everyone three grades above me in my organization to know about JSON and endpoints and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But if we're going to have people writing OData endpoints, we're going to, at some stage, there's going to have to be some explanation of what the hell's going on.
Mm. Yeah. You know, it makes me think. It's sort of like it's a rare exception that you get those. I haven't read this book, but you get those books that's like Guns, Germs, and Steel or something.
Yeah.
And it is, that is, I assume, and from what I've heard of that ancient book or ancient now, like it basically is describing the back end of history.
Yes.
Right?
Like
these things that, well, everyone likes, well, not everyone, but people are interested in guns, but let's set that aside. But you know, when it comes to just sort of like steel and germs and guns, like people aren't really interested in that. They're interested in, as we would say in computer marketing, the outcomes. But it is somehow that was an interesting book that people liked. And I guess like it, you know, I've kind of come to learn that there's maybe building on your pixels thing, three ways that people decide to use some new technology. One of them is the one we technology oriented people always hope for, because it's cool and looks good. Right. And
XML.
I would put under the rubric of cool of like does a good job and improves things, right? You're just like it's sort of the equivalent of I don't know, I'm staring, our landlord's left behind a bunch of Apple airport things, which is a whole other story. But I'm looking at one now that you can hook an external hard drive up to, and then you can back up your stuff over the network, right? And so like one, that's cool. Because it's just like, ooh, network hard drive. And then two, it's also very practical, right? Like I plug in my thing and it's backed up. But like if you were to describe that to most people, maybe I'm being arrogant, but I bet they would be like your people. They would walk away and just be like, I mean, I think he might have been speaking, Italian to me. I'm not really sure what was happening with that guy.
Yes, and it obviously it's at several levels. So there will be some minority audience who would say, love it. Bring me 10, and there will be a majority audience who, I mean, in a way, this is a big thing that Apple do, is you have to sell an idea that's understandable. This is one of the one thing I've thought about some of the Apple stuff is it's actually easier to take stuff away than to add it. Because if you take stuff away, you don't really have to explain a lot. But if you're adding a new thing, you do have to kind of convince people that it's worth the extra money or worth, you know, swapping cables, whatever. But if you're just taking it away, it's like, hey, that's that problem solved. We don't make printers anymore. We don't make Wi-Fi boxes anymore. It's just like, I don't know, buy it from someone else or solve your problem some other way.
Yeah, yeah. I like that. I haven't thought about that much, but I also every now and then notice that part of the Apple. Would it be ethos? Where they're sort of like, oh, this thing is reprehensible and terrible, and we're not going to do it. But you sort of do need printers, so someone else can take care of that bullshit, but not
and,
us.
And big screens. You know, remember when they had that all that key LG screen that they said people should buy? But
So then I think the second thing that motivates people in my theory here is, as you say, you put pixels on the screen, which is. You make them somehow realize that this thing is useful and that it has like a manifestation, right? It's not just like this theoretic thing. Like, here's a diagram of a workflow of how we handle case management. And now that we understand this thing and can manipulate it, we can actually improve the case flow workflow. And if you just kind of go over that with people, again, you're speaking Italian to them. I don't mean to pick on the Italians, but like until they actually see some like simple thing they can just click on, like there's no way to understand it, which I think is fine. Like that's a normal human thing until you see something demonstrated. But then I think the third thing, which I don't know, I think in the majority of cases, I don't know if this happens in the consumer space. I think the consumer area is different than like the business space. But definitely in the business space, I think, I don't know, 75 to 90% of the time, it's this third category of like urgency. And that's the only reason anyone ever changes. And there's some
looming disaster.
Yes. Let's say you have, let's call them the decision maker, right? And some people like to be nice and call them stakeholders or something like as if they're hunting vampires or something. Yep. But you've got the decision maker, and they will never decide to do anything different because they have their life to live and everything's fine and whatever. But until there's some external pressure, whether that's a mandate from someone or, as you say, there's some looming disaster, they'll never decide to change. So you always need this, as they say, sense of urgency to change over. And then once you get that, everything just kind of flows from it. It's you can convince them of your case management workflow or your printers or whatever.
They just need
a solution.
Yeah, it could be, what's it called? Regulatory pressure. It could just be, this thing we're doing now is no longer legal.
Yeah, like have you heard about GDPR? Have you encountered that, Robert?
I've never heard of it. It's not my area.
At this point, I am convinced that is why the UK is leaving the EU. They saw this GDPR looming, and they were like, "Fuck that shit, I'm out."
Yes. No, I'm not saying yes. I'm not saying anything about that. Your third point, the point about external pressures, I think there's also part of that, I think, is also internal pressures. Mm. Because I occasionally speak with people and I think to myself, the reason this person isn't necessarily engaging as we might wish with this particular thing we're talking about isn't because they're dumb. It's because they're very busy. And it's like,
right.
There are some people in, let's say, technology, a minority of people, but some people nonetheless, who seem to believe that when they're talking about technology to what you call business users, that they spend their whole days in front of their application on a special laptop. No. I mean, they might, you know, make reference to your application or your system, you know, once a day, once a week, maybe. So their view of what you're talking about is quite different. And it's like, yeah, what's this meeting about? The procurement system? All right, whatever. I can spare you 20 minutes, maybe. And the assumption occasionally that, hey, these business guys don't know what they're talking about. It's like, no, they're busy. They have other things to talk about. And the stuff they're busy with may well be more important than 20 minutes talking about the procurement system. Mm. But that is a perennial gap, really. Mm. And I think it to some extent, the Air Force stuff reminded me of that, of the, how shall I put this, the kind of small T theatrics of, well, okay, how do we, if there is no middle ground, how do we make something that feels and looks like middle ground between business function and technical function?
Mm.
And how do we make it okay for people to be in a room and, you know, just shoot the breeze and talk about stuff?
Yeah. They need a different uniform, as you say.
Yeah. A different uniform, you know, a different de Bono hat to put on.
Oh, boy.
Hey, I'm 46. I'm all about De Bono.
De Bono. I think that's yeah, and you know, another aspect of large organization change when it comes to technology that comes up there. I mean, back to the external thing is like there is someone realized that it was the process that was fucking everything up.
Yeah.
and yeah, that's really like, that's like an advanced epiphany to have. Like,
yeah.
I think it's difficult for people to, it's like, I mean, you know, not, I always dislike referencing other podcasts, but every now and then over in the John Roderick world of podcast, they get to talking about like local government.
Yeah.
And he runs very quickly to the problem is process or
yes.
frame of mind. Like it doesn't, yeah. the content yeah. is never the problem. It's just like the system is yeah. the issue, which I don't know. Like those kind of points, it's almost like a convex curve. There you go. A
yeah.
U, as they say.
Yeah.
I hate words. You should just say like a U-shaped curve instead of convex. But
yeah.
like it seems like a lot of when you realize process is the problem kind of falls in this convex curve of stuff of like, or I guess it would be the other way. But it's just like it's either really easy to solve or really hard to solve. And there's like no real in between when it comes to solving process, which is frustrating.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't know. I sort of trailed off there.
No, I think it's right, and I think it's there's an element of, you know, a prophet is not without honor to some of this, in that one can sometimes be speaking with people who are, you know, their job is what's on their desk. That's what they're paid to do. That's what they're hired to do. And then there's a big, big gap, and there's some, you know, C-level executive who's all about the strategy. And you think, well, wait a minute, there's a big gap in the middle there. There's a big gap of perception and thinking about these systems, kind of mid to high range stuff. And that's a yawning gap in some organizations, in that people, you know, it's not like people don't want to think about it. It's that there's no one in the building paid to.
Mm.
And it's like you're either down at shoveling at the in the boiler room, or you're captain of the ship, and there's nothing in between. You think, how do you think this is going to work? No, we're optimizing for the past.
Mm.
But it seems to be, and I understand it, because it's the easiest thing to do. It's, if we optimize for the past, you're following a well-trodden route, and it's predictable, and it's understandable. But if you're optimizing for the future, all of that feels like risk. And it's very easy to say, hey, the most risky thing is not to take any risks. But there's still that barrier between what's thought of as experimentation and what's thought of as business as usual.
Mm.
And I think some of the technology stuff, particularly some of the stuff that you've been talking about recently, is pushing at that sort of porous barrier of, well, all right, like I've always said in the past, I used to work for Time Warner doing some stuff on their intranet. And the first thing I wanted to say is, look, don't call it the intranet. So we'll solve the problem of people not being interested in the intranet by we're not going to admit that it is the intranet. So don't call it R&D. Just don't. we've got to grab these things and move forward. Otherwise, we're just going to be rolled over. But it's a difficult thing to invite people to look at, because it does look like risk, and to a great extent, it is.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like the motto is, you know, we assumed we'd never need to change, which is fair. And I mean, back to a as a tangent on an aside you had there. Like, I think the idea of I'm just busy, that's a good frame of mind for self care. That sounds good. Yeah. Like, if you get frustrated, be like, no, I'm just busy. That's why things are all fucked up. Like, I got a lot of stuff going on. And then, I think the trap you have to not fall into is the trap of, so I should go finally read that Getting Things Done book. like opposite of what we were just saying, you should just be like, nah, I'm just busy. Things are, and there's no way I can optimize this process. So I should just accept that. It's no problem. Yeah.
And you could in a way, do an Apple and start stopping. And literally just say, well, okay, what am I busy with? What can I stop being busy with?
Yeah, that's good.
Just drop certain things out. Because one of the things I've found is quite often, I'm just too tired. I'm just too tired to do things. And recently I was writing some very, very trivial code to do a very trivial task. And my interaction with the person I was working with was, hey, I know. I could write this. I can write this parser. It would be fine. And it's been like 3 weeks. It's just embarrassing. And this is stuff that I could do in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like I want to stay awake long enough to eat. And then
it's the metaphoric, like, you know, old man pulls his back doing some trivial sport thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I let myself, it was a shallow one, but fall in one of these holes this morning where for some reason I was like, all right, I'm finally going to go figure out, like, how did this microblog thing works? And then I noticed somewhere that they've got I'm about to say a bunch of words that I barely know what they mean, but they've got a micropub API. And they had some instructions for hooking it up to IFTTT. And you were supposed to map these things that it had. And of course, cutting and pasting the thing and then, you know, doing the little bit of changes straight up didn't work. Right? Or I shouldn't say straight up. It worked, but it had, isn't one of Larry Wall's best principles that software should do what you expect it to, which is a typically tautologically useless statement from someone. It's just like, what is the alternative? Anyhow.
Or dump.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, it basically, you know, just it was supposed to be escaping something and it'd include the escape characters. And I don't know. So I just.
Oh, I saw in your feed.
Exactly. Yeah. So I just gave up. But that is like I I think the improvement that I made, maybe you could call it mean time to give up. And like, I think it's reduced significantly since last time. I only spent like 90 minutes doing it before I just like gave up.
Yeah.
And
I have two things on this. I am going to interrupt you on this because I'm a rude person. But I have a friend. Yes, Robert, you are. Yes, you are.
Well, you know, I forget if we talked about this at some point.
How rude you are, Robert.
No, but you know, I've had many long discussions with people about like let's call it interrupt-driven conversation. Man, that's I wouldn't say it's a fraught topic, but it's a mini face topic that's got a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah. What was I thinking about?
About microblogging or something.
Microblog. So recently, Tumblr. What was I thinking? So I'm trying to not go into the kind of meta levels too much. But recently, I was doing stuff on Tumblr because I look at Tumblr and it's nice. It feels nice. It works. I press the button. Things happen, and it's got nice things like the queue and drafts and blah blah blah, and it's all fine. Until relatively recently. And relatively recently, I think someone within the organization, Oath or whoever they are now, thought, you know what? Tumblr, very old-fashioned. What we need to do is mix it up a bit and make it more modern. And it's just, it's the anything that's not using the app and pressing the right button is starting to come apart. So the what's it called? Those URL schemes. You remember all that stuff?
In Tumblr?
Yeah. So you had Tumblr :// something.
I didn't realize they had URL schemes. I thought it was just like a bunch of random numbers, like maybe the date and then random numbers or something.
Oh no! Not the HTTPS stuff.
Ah, right.
But when you're in iOS, you can have a URL that's actually TUMBLR.
Right. That's so you can hook it up to drafts or workflow or whatever. Yeah.
Only now it's, hey, you've got a user API, a new API, and it's all, oh boy, I don't want to get into this, you know, the OAuth 2 and all that sort of stuff. And it used to work. And there's a lot of that happening. So the web view and the iOS app view are now looking different. And I just thought, okay, I've had enough, and went back to microblog. And there's two words I have for you on microblog. And those two words are Manton Rees. Manton's the person who originally came up with the code, and he's done, you know, writing about it and pushed it for ages and ages and ages, done all this work. The really nice thing about Manton Rees is so boring. So boring. He just works. And every time I look at something, and every time I've looked at something on microblog and I've thought to myself, hey, that's a bit weird, I just wait. And he fixes it or explains why it worked like that, and he's just trudging through. And he hasn't stopped. I mean, he's one person. He can only work so fast. But he's just plowed through this stuff. And I look at something like Tumblr, and I think, I don't know what's going on at Tumblr. I can't write to, you know, Mr. Tumblr and ask them what they're doing. Yet I can have that connection to some extent with Manton Rees and with the community around it, maybe because it's just so small at the moment. But it just feels like someone's actually doing things.
Yeah. He seems like a nice version of whoever that dude who runs Pinboard is.
Oh, Maciek. Yeah.
Sure.
I've probably murdered his name. I mean, you're more European than I am, Kote.
I'm on the continent having a continental breakfast.
So that early feeling about Tumblr, of there's a button that says photo, there's a button that says chat, that kind of stuff, seems to have fallen away. And now, particularly in the iOS app, it's like, what am I looking at here? I don't understand what, you know, it's doing too much behind the scenes.
Yeah.
But I am definitely going to plug on with microblog. Even though there's a lot of it that I just look at and I think, oh, please change this. Please make the font size bigger. please.
Well, you can add some custom CSS, right? So you can make your font size bigger.
Not to an app.
Oh, right. Not to an app. Yeah, that's true. I was just thinking of the web page, but yes.
Yeah, but it feels to me like I look at it and I just think someone's working on this and they're not stopping and they've worked for months and months and months and years and years and years. Great. Will I give this person $5 a month? Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that that's true. It's good to see like a stream of features. Yeah. I mean, I always go back to the WordPress. I don't know why I said the WordPress.
Yep.
But I just basically nowadays I just want like a version of Pinboard that's just like a blog. That's all I'm interested in is like, and it all gets down to like the as they say the workflow on an iOS device where I want to read something, and then use that share sheet, and basically bookmark it with tags so I can search for it later and maybe excerpt something. And the only thing I've ever figured out that works, that it isn't full of a bunch of like, you know, porn like Tumblr, you bookmark it to Pinboard, and then you use the IFTTT to like cross post it to WordPress. And the thing you sacrifice there is you can't use like Markdown or anything. And then you're pretty much set. And then it also, the secondary features are like, I would also like to have like static pages sometimes, and maybe actually write long posts that are there. And I don't know. You know, the thing that often stops me is like, I don't even know why I care anymore. Like, I don't think
I try not to say that every time. Yeah. I try not to. I'm, you know, you don't know the effort it takes not to say this.
Yeah. Because on an annual basis, what I realize is that like, and this is like, you know, I'll just say one, I don't know what you consider yourself, but one old person talking about, you know, the old web or whatever, like I'm like Jaron Lanier or something, just like, whatever you say his name, all upset about Lawnmower Man or Squids or something. Yeah. But, you know, everyone's in Instagram and then everyone's in Twitter. And then some people are in Medium, and just like, that's what you got, right? Like there's no one reads all the other shit. Like I was listening to some podcast the other day, and then the great revelation that someone had was like using RSS feeds.
Yes.
And I was just like, yeah, I mean,
well done.
Sure. Bro. Good job. But that's where we are. Like people don't, there's no RSS feeds anymore. So therefore, still, I would like there to be sort of like a record. You know what I mean? Like, this is probably something you think a lot about, but like, I would like to find some service that is like just a record of things that have happened, or, you know, the junk that I've made. And there's always some things that like Memento, or I forget what they're called.
Yeah.
Things that come and go there, but there's always some problem with them. Like, they don't like, they're not like fully representative. And, I don't know what to do about that. Like I said, I think ultimately, like it doesn't matter. Like it's and then the thing that I start to think about is more of the inward facing thing of like, you know, I took a screenshot of my phone recently, and someone pointed out something I hadn't realized, is that like on my home screen of my phone, I have four different note taking apps. So obviously there's something going on there. Plus there's the ones like every now and then.
You're on well.
That's right. Every now and then I go back to using like MindMeister or something, right?
Yes.
Because I think like, I should have a mind map. And then so I got that one on there too. And it's just like there's something wrong happening. Or I don't know, maybe it's not wrong. Maybe it's what's supposed to be happening. But like there's all these like, I need like CD-ROMs for my notes, you know, some multimedia stuff.
Yeah. And, well, to some extent it feels like, I mean, there's that, yeah, notes.pinboard.in, Pinboard Notes, still worth a look. To some extent, there's that whole thing of something I've heard over the last kind of 2 or 3 years has been, hey, we're at the early days of the internet, which is an interesting idea. I'm not entirely convinced, but the one thing about the earliness of it is does seem to be that things change quite rapidly. So I still think of the inevitability of a a post-Twitter, post-Facebook internet. And in my lifetime of looking at the internet, Twitter and Facebook are recent. And I think that they will, at some stage, they will be in the rearview mirror. And it's difficult to that, but it's true. And, you know, stuff like RSS comes and goes. And lots of these things are going to come and go. And it's going to take some while to settle down. I mean, I think in the early days of printing, people were thinking, you know, shall we have illustrations? What the paper size is going to be? And, you know, shall we have page numbers? That kind of stuff. We're at the same stage. But there's something particularly about the note-taking and your commonplace book stuff, which I like. And this, I think, comes together with something that you were speaking about previously, which is motivation. And some of that I think of as what do people enjoy? And I don't mean, you know, kind of mad stuff, but what small M motivation. And some of the stuff that you've done on the commonplace book stuff, even in the digital, the pure digital bit, feels to me, and I know this is a strange way of thinking about it, it feels delightful, like small d delightful. It's like looking over someone's shoulder and thinking, oh, that's nice. And that's enough to start, just to look over someone's shoulder and think, oh, that's nice, or oh, that's interesting. And it's an easier way to communicate after that. And some of these things are just nice. And I keep turning over these ideas in my head. And if I was awake for long enough, I'd be able to actually do them, of all sorts of silly little things. But I think to myself, well, yeah, they're silly, or they seem inconsequential, but they are ways of communicating that are bizarrely more accessible than putting something in pixels and putting it in HTML. Which was supposed to be the most accessible thing. You know, hypermedia, hypertext was the most accessible thing. And now, if I say to someone, oh, I've made a website, you might as well be slapping them in the face. It's like...
Yeah, that's true. They have to.
Why would
go,
I care?
They have to go out there. But yeah, I mean to talk about myself more. I mean, that is like what you describe is like what I like consuming. Right, like it just that sort of delightfulness. It's like it's like wandering around a bookstore or something. Although the bookstore, I mean, if there was more mixed media in there, but I always want to just like, as you say, look over people's shoulder and see what they're doing. And it's hard to find anything that does that for yourself or for publishing, I guess. I don't know. It's annoying. And that's why I always go back to that microblog thing, because it looks really nice, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And it has that whole, I don't know, I wouldn't call it minimalist, but it has a minimalist in the sense of like not a whole bunch of jazzy stuff, right?
Yeah.
Like,
which for me is the key thing of just let me give you money. You know, just if you want right, to take $5 off me, and the what I'm buying for $5 is the inside of Manton's head, a relatively small but reasonable community around it, and it working how I expect most of the time, lots of development happening, and it goes without saying, but it needs to be said, no ads.
That's right.
And I just go to a web page, I type stuff, and there we go. Mm-hmm. And now that seems to be something that... you have to pay for, which is terrifying.
Yeah, you know, I think maybe also who someone I learned this aspirational habit from is like over the years, like Bruce Sterling has done weird stuff, not weird, but interesting stuff with publishing. Yeah. Like he used to have a, I don't think it's around anymore. He had a Wired blog, and I every now and then I go to try to find an RSS feed for it, and it just like doesn't exist, but. And he would just like, you could tell he was just like rummaging through his stuff of the day. And sometimes he would just, you know, cut and paste like a 10-page newsletter.
Yeah.
or just whatever. And he does this a little bit on his Tumblr thing nowadays. He doesn't publish there very much, but he'll have, he's always got a lot of maps of like the Internet of Things vendor landscape, or he's always big into, like, you know, as I'm sure he would say in his what's the word for this? Not snarky, but just sort of like down talking. You're an idiot if you think it's weird that I'm saying this tone.
Yes.
Of just like, here's some pictures of global warming, you know. Here's that dog in a house on fire with his mug. See you later, right?
Yeah.
But I think where he does it really well in a much more narrow band thing is if you follow his like Flickr feed, you can kind of tell they're sort of like they're almost like notes to himself that he's taking pictures of, and his pictures are like not very good.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like they're not really like. They're done more for just like the information in the picture than for like, you know, here's like a really nice, like, you know, I've done my law of thirds golden ratio stuff on this river that's going into the woods or whatever. And so that's like it's fun to like look at his stuff over his shoulder and kind of like, I don't know, not even do anything with it. Just look at it.
I think part of this is that, again, that Seth Godin idea of smallest possible audience. Mm. And another symptom of this is you remember the Flickr interesting feed, which is the most crushingly tedious thing, and it's all that it's people who have perfected photography without the art and without the interest, and it's all waterfalls and it's all perfectly captured, and why would you look at it? You know, it's like postcards. And it's the more odd stuff or the more particular things that people do look at. And I'm still an optimist. I mean, and things like Microbog do make me not give up. And the key to all is it's a bit like the weather. If you don't like Twitter, just wait. It'll go away. And it really will. I mean, it's kind of going away now.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's not good for me. It needs to stay around until I cash out.
Your exit. You're thinking you're going to make big bucks somewhere.
Yeah. I mean I can't imagine how I would do my work without Twitter around. Of course anytime someone says I can't imagine, that means there's a perfectly imaginable way for it to happen, if not five. Yeah. But
so do you mean as an input or an output or both?
Oh, mostly an output. I don't really get input from Twitter that much anymore. It's just kind of, I don't know. I don't know what the story with that is, but, cause there's a lot of interesting content there. It's just like, I don't know. I don't care.
Well, this sounds like you're describing the future, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I know lots of people like that. I know someone who's a photographer. I mean, he's a photographer for money, so he takes photos of people because they pay him to. And he's on Twitter, and the stuff he posts on Twitter is basically, you know, like brand recognition. Hey, I'm the photographer. Maybe you should hire me. And then it's out for a week.
Mm.
And it's weird. It's like putting almost like a small ad in a newspaper, knowing that there are other small ads around your small ad, and you can't really control. I mean, my personal feeling is that if I was an organization of any sort, putting anything on Twitter doesn't seem like a good idea. It's just like and people have said to me, what's your alternative? And it's a bit like someone saying, okay, you say you don't want to punch yourself in the face, well, what's your alternative? And my suggestion is not punching myself in my face.
Mm-hmm.
That's my just to not take that action is my alternative.
That's a good you know, there's another thing, like when I was working on that Air Force thing, I was writing in one of my multifaceted, how do you say, like all of your things, one of my multifarious, no, that means evil, anyways, one of my mini journals, like, oh, this week I've done that thing where you just focus on doing one thing and it has great results. and like, I think, you know, to that end, or not to that end, related to what you're saying, there is a question of like, to use maybe a fraught example, like it's not like Paul Graham is on Twitter a lot, as far as I know, or writes a lot. Now, in contrast, you got that, what's his name, Sanofsky, that dude who used to run Windows at Microsoft. Yeah. And he seems to write a lot.
Yeah.
So those are two interesting different poles. And like the first guy, the Paul Graham guy, who I forget all of the things that's wrong with him. I'm sure there's all sorts of, as they say, problematic things.
Oh, yeah, but, yeah, yeah.
But
of course.
He seems to not be in the world much.
Yeah.
Or at least the online world, if that's still a phrase. And instead, he just pops in there every now and then. And I guess you could say that the old Joel on Software person is like that. And then and then also usually in my little area of cloud native stuff or cloud or whatever, there's often people who are not very active in social things, and then they write something, and then it's a big deal or whatever. So I often think maybe I should just focus on medium-sized pieces of good work. And not worry so much about all this pablum shit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is I agree. And also that thing of someone got in touch with me over SMS recently, and basically said, well, have you Robert kind of retreated from the internet? And
obviously, they haven't been following you for the past 5 to 10 years.
And my thing was, well, not really.
It's Robert's annual retreat from the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
He'll be back next year.
Persephone going to the underworld.
Exactly. Very good.
To go down and count pomegranate seeds and come back up again. See, after Twitter dies, and say, I told you it was dying. But it's not a kind of massive thing, but. The thing there was that it's not just, hey, I'm busy doing stuff, but I know people where I work who either have a very small or no public web presence, who do very good work a lot of the time, all the time. And I know a couple of people who have been kind of bounced into, hey, you should write a blog post. And they write the blog post, and you read the blog post, and you think, man, we shouldn't have made this person write a blog post. They're terrible at writing blog posts. Yeah, they're good at what they're good at. You know, just let this person be good at what they're good at, and don't bounce them into writing stuff that they don't want to write, into being the sort of person they don't want to be. You know, it's like anything. It's like saying, well, hey, you should have a Twitter account. Why? You know, you've got to work out where the value is. What again, with the motivation, I often think of, what do people value? Not just money value, not the financial value, but what are they into? You know, am I having a meeting with someone who's into the thing we're talking about? And if they're not, I'm not going to dismiss them, but it helps if they're into it. You know, that's a kind of driving thing.
Mm.
And most people aren't, again, at school or in the army. So you don't usually get to tell them to be interested in stuff.
Mm.
And usually, nowadays, if for most of the people that we might know, I know, and certainly that I know, if they're not into it, they'll leave. They'll get a different job. They'll go and work for someone else. And you can't compel people to be engaged with things. You have to give them a reason. You have to give enough to pull on, really.
Yeah, I see what you mean by motivation. That's always a mystery to me. Why? What people do, not what they do, but
why they do it.
Yeah, yeah. Like if you finish pulling the thread of the sweater, where does it end up? Right, like you have this chain of events of why you do all these things, right? Like, you know, I gotta wake up in the morning and brush my teeth because I gotta go to the work, so I make the money so that I can, I don't know, buy the food, so that I can what? And it is, I don't know. It's confusing, and then you have the thing of are there actual? I think we talked about this a while ago, but like when I think about being a like, you know, all the multiple things. There's this word I keep wanting to find called multifaceted. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah.
All of the multiple things you could do as a writer, right?
Yeah.
Like, I worry about the motivation of the audience, because they're the ones who, you know, consume the stuff. And,
yeah.
And, like, you know, there's all these blogs that are, like, TV show recaps.
Yes.
And I don't understand. Like, every now and then I want to go search for, like, a TV show or movie explanation, right?
Yeah.
Like, what just happened here? But not just like a recap or thinking about what's going to happen next, but it's more just like, you know, what was that giant foot statue and Lost? What was that?
Yeah.
Or, you know, what is this lyric for the song mean or something? But
yeah, just tell me things.
Yeah, yeah, but I people love like recaps, and I guess cultural stuff. People might want to know about what's going on in culture, but it goes back to the looking over the shoulder thing. I think what I've slowly realized over the year is it's just entertaining. Like, I think entertainment is an end, right? Like, it's a cul-de-sac of causation. It's just like, entertainment, fine, done. If it's entertaining to you, we don't need an explanation of why you're being entertained. Like, that's finished.
To an extent, yes. But I think I used to very, very crudely, selfishly, and dismissively think of people as either being primarily motivated by amusement or primarily motivated by interest. And I think that's way too crude, but also still useful to some extent. So if you think of people who are collectors of particular things or consumers of particular things, it's weird because some people just pursue things. I can't really explain it. Like, someone who's into, you know, Horatio Nelson or something like that, and collects books on Nelson, and, you know, writes stories about Nelson, and has a blog about Nelson. There's part of that looking over their shoulder. And there's also part of a kind of, well, I'm glad someone's doing this. And particularly on the web, I think that, because there's a lot of gaps on the web. So even something like, you know, if you were to say something like History of Amsterdam, and you'd say, well, obviously there's a history of Amsterdam on the web. Well, of course there is. But there isn't one, let's imagine, that works on a mobile phone, that doesn't require JavaScript, that works over 3G, that has properly sized images, that is in a format that people can access quickly. And it's like there are these endless gaps of, in a way, as you describe, I just want a website that does X. Well, some of those websites don't exist. A lot of them don't exist. In fact, a lot of them are dying out. So if I want to do a kind of like a timeline of history of where I live, there isn't one.
That would be fun.
There simply isn't.
It's like that thing you sent me a while ago. It's the Amsterdam Museum of Shit We Found in the Ground.
Yeah. And you
which
look
is
at,
fascinating.
Yeah, and people were fascinated. And the thing that I found most notable about that is it reminded me, okay, here's old man coming out. It reminded me of the web 15 to 20 years ago. Of here is a huge amount of information that we have made accessible that we are inviting people to interact with on their terms. You can look at stuff, you can scroll here, you can look at these photos. There isn't an infinite scroll. You aren't being channeled through a particular route. And there was no shame in reference material almost. And now it's gone the other way. And Google Maps is an interesting example of this, that Google Maps is amazing and the changes on it are similarly amazing. But looking at Google Maps now, it's, again, much less of a reference thing and much more of a Google-type digital mirror for the user. So when I look at Google Maps, I see places I've visited and semi-advertising based on the stuff I'm into. And yeah, okay, it's still a map, but it's more of a kind of guide now, which is fine, but it leaves a gap. It leaves a gap for maps, and lots of stuff that's being developed on the web seems to leave a gap for the past, you know, kind of like, just, can you just show me a map? Just let me zoom, anything, you know, just like Flickr is a good example of this. Is there a site that just, I can just have photos and not all the craft around it? Mm. Just the core thing. Just give me the core thing. And yeah, again, Pinboard Notes is a kind of echo of that. Give me a text area. I'll type stuff in. I'll press return. Done.
Yeah, you know how you were having your Tumblr complaining or notes on Tumblr about how it, I don't know. As I would say, the people who write this obviously don't use it, right, this software.
Yeah.
Flickr has this annoyance too, where like, in, you could kind of use their app and just browse photos, but for whatever reason, they decided that the titles and descriptions that people put in when they upload their photos are, should not be easily displayed to the end user.
Yeah.
Which,
which, so if you wanted that,
yeah, you have to go all the way to like the info page, or I don't know, it's just crazy, but it is it's frustrating to look through that. But you know, I think it's just this delight of consuming stuff, whether it's just I don't know, whether it's TV show recaps or the TV show on its own, or like. You know, speaking of another common, another sort of like, what would you call it? Form that I follow that I try to copy is like, how do you say his name? Warren Ellis. He has this weekly newsletter from what the hell is a Thames Delta? Thames.
The Thames Delta.
Yeah. He's always like, I'm writing from the Thames Delta.
Yeah. It's the, if you imagine London and you headed on the river Thames, east, towards the channel, and the river gets wider and wider and wider.
A delta, you might call it.
A delta, and has these very, well, as he has admitted, kind of weird places. And there are big flat islands, or big for the UK, where hardly anyone lives, and kind of remote communities and weird historical relics. There's these things called Palmerston Forts, which were built to defend us against, speaking of the nation of shopkeepers, Napoleon.
Oh,
and
Napoleon.
They hardly got any use, but they're still there. And you can see them on Google Maps, and they're these weird sort of castles half sunk into the mud. And they're quite big, some of them. Very strange. But yeah, that's his end.
So it's his whole like his whole poetic rhetoric of saying, I mean, the Thames Delta is like, it's this sort of like vaguely familiar kind of weird environment that I exist in, which is like his whole deal or mystique, as we used to say. So anyhow, he had this link. I mean, he always has links to like little ephemera, not always, but sometimes. And he had a link to this thing, I don't know, Sir Mortimer and Magnus, which was some like ancient BBC Two thing where like, have you heard of this?
No.
It's delightful to use that word, but it's basically like, as how would you say, English gentleman scholar as you will ever find, just like telling stories about like, you know, England in 1100. And then he's some kind of historian, and he's got the whole like, he's got like a crazy mustache and the eyes that are just like going, and he's like constantly like as if he's sitting on like a tack. He's constantly like shifting around, and I'm pretty sure he's wearing a tweed suit. And then he has, I don't even know how you would describe like the tone and accent and everything he has, but it's just like, yep, it's that one, that guy.
I need to track this down.
Oh yeah, and I've only seen like, I watched like 10 minutes of it the other day, and it's delightful. But anyways, that's another thing is like, this person found some delight in like knowing all this stuff, and they're like work is to sit here and tell you about it. And maybe they wrote some books. I don't actually know who this Sir Mortimer is, but then there was someone else who was like, wouldn't it be delightful if we recorded this person talking and broadcast that to people, like, and then we'll just call it a day. Like we've done something.
Yeah.
And then also, back to, I think like Warren Ellis is one of those people who would be fun to like look over that person's notes, right? Yes. Like whatever it is they got going on is like just an interesting stream. Like, you know, you almost want to just like look through their recycling bin. Like the garbage is probably gross, but like whatever's going on in their computer's trash file and just the things in their Dropbox and the recycling bin is probably fun.
I think this is it's the thing that particularly I find interesting is that I am not that interested in his books.
Mm.
I am very interested in what he might think of as almost ephemera. And it's a kind of, I think, exactly as you described, it's a particular feeling, a particular way of thinking. So quite often I'll talk to people in a work environment, usually. So I was talking to someone recently who had a notebook and a pencil and was writing stuff down. And I said, well, wait a minute, what are you writing down? And he showed me the stuff. And I was looking at this thinking, this stuff is gold. This stuff is amazing. And he said, what do you mean? I said, are you thinking about all this stuff? He says, yeah. I don't say it to anybody because it's a complete waste of time. And I said, look, all these are good things. All these are things are interesting things which a lot of people would be interested in. And he looked at me almost baffled. It's like, what do you mean? I mean, these are just like scribbled notes to myself. And quite often that looking at someone's shoulder, you know, consensually, as it were, you get a glimpse into a different way of thinking, and it's quite raw in a way, and it's not constructed. It's just, it's a very honest kind of, this is how I think, bang, 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 out it comes. In a way, that's what people have said about the photos that I've taken, is that unanswerable question of how do you pick, why do you take this particular photo? Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's just, it's almost like stopping someone in the street and saying, why are you whistling that song? I don't know.
That's right. It's the series of like trashy stuff on the street, raindrops on the windows, and kaleidoscopes.
Yeah.
What was the name for that in Flickerland?
Discover.
Yeah.
Oh God.
It's almost like, I mean, Art Brut is a little too like hoity-toity, ironically enough. But it's almost like the not a big deal version of Art Brut. It's like it's like just life brute or something.
Yes.
No need for it to be art.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. Yeah. And yes.
Oh, I was gonna say we should have a few tiny topics. And then wrap up. Here's what I want to know. Now, I think you would pronounce this cooker. Do you have these in? I think you have them up there. Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. It's like this faucet, and through a magic like manipulation of your fingers, an incantation thing, a gesticular incantation, it will instantly spit out boiling water. Which
I've seen them advertised.
Mm.
I don't think I've ever seen one IRL.
Mm.
And I have a typically, I'm going to say English, a fear of such advanced technology when it comes to plumbing.
This is going to result in another blitz if we install this. Well, you know, like we could fill several episodes with the delightful things in this house that I would never consider buying on my own, but this
You're
is one
booked.
Of that's right. But this is one of them.
I like never consider buying on my own. That's good. Why is this here?
That's right. Who would buy such a thing?
Who would buy this? Not me, that's for sure.
But so we have this cooker, which is, as I describe, is a faucet. It's the kitchen faucet, and you do this twist thing for safety, so kids don't burn their face off. And and boiling water, 100 degrees centigrade, or I think it's 225 degrees Fahrenheit, comes out instantly. Now, there's a small catch. Like any piece of technology, you actually have to turn it on for it to work. So be aware of that. And you have to let it like heat up for a little while. But then, boom, like literally, I mean, I'm stressing this because I just didn't believe it. It's just like boiling water, right? Comes out. Yeah, it's true though. It's true. I mean, they have videos where like you put this boiling water in pasta and it cooks the pasta. But I used it and I made some tea because there's also some leftover tea here in the house, and I think it's green
tea. Straight out of this tap thing.
Yeah. So you put the tea in the cup. In this case, it was loose leaf tea because I can't find the little tea balls or whatever. And I know coffee, not tea. So then you put the tea in the cup and then you do the little thing and you turn the cooker on and boom, it just like hot water comes out and cooks your tea or whatever you call that. And it's amazing. And so I was thinking, now is my chance to do like a pour over thing. So of course I went to the wire cutter and they had some recommendations, but I always go to the one that's like, what if you have more money than sense? Which one would you buy?
Chick here.
That's right.
Yes, I do.
And so I bought the Chimex? How do you say it?
How do I say it?
I mean, you seem like someone who would have one of these things.
Yeah, I've had and broken one, yes. Mm.
So I bought one of these. So my question is, how do I operate this thing? I got the filters and I got the Chimex. Or whatever. Now, do I have to grind the coffee some special way? Like, what do I do? What goes on with this?
No. Just it's basically ground coffee. Mm-hmm. So Chemex, filter paper in the top, ground coffee in the filter, water over the top, and everything else is like tweaks on that. Mm. But that's basically it.
And then what's your coffee to water ratio? How's that going to work out?
I have no idea. The way I do it, I used to try to do it kind of like. You know, by the numbers, and I just can't be bothered now. I do it by eye and like weight in my hand, basically.
Mm.
But
hand weight.
Yeah. The weight of a human hand.
This is the equivalent of weighing yourself in stones instead of kilograms. I think.
Yeah, exactly. It's like I am the king's cubit now when it comes to coffee making. But I've got to tell you, seriously, I can say this without fear of contradiction because I'm the only person who thinks this, is that I always used to think, well, okay, if I don't make very good coffee, at least I can go out and buy nice coffee because there's always coffee places. And now I think to myself, and slowly over the years, it got to, I make okay coffee now. And now it's to the stage of, yeah, there's only a couple of places out there that make coffee that I would prefer to buy than making it, and I make mostly straight black coffee in a filter.
Like
really old style.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. I just absolutely love it. It's so straightforward, and so I don't even have a Chemex anymore. I literally have like a almost like a, you know, like a funnel thing.
Oh yeah, you get it put on top of the cup. You get one of those
really
guys.
Yeah, really, really basic. Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
Well, I hadn't thought about it, but like I'm the same way. Like, I notice it because I come over here, and I can't get a good cup of coffee. Mm. I shouldn't say good. I can't get one that I like, and so I as a substitute, like when I get the chance, I'll go to just prepare yourself, everyone. I go to like a Starbucks, and I just get like a coffee, and I'm like, at least I know this. Right. And I also know that it's like super effective.
Yeah.
Whereas like we have a coffee machine here and I make coffee in it, and I've been here like, I guess a month now. And I still don't feel like it's coffee. Like it's not like back at home.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping with the, Chemex, I don't know how to say that.
It is Chemex.
Okay. That like, that's a weird name for a coffee machine anyways, I feel like I can tune it because you can do these small batches in theory.
Then
also I can just, it's just for some reason it seems easier to make coffee with that than to basically do the equivalent with a coffee machine.
I'm not really sure why. Yes. Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Because it feels like, apart from my feeling of, look, I know where the water is, I know where the coffee beans are, mm-hmm. and I know how long it's going to take to get from there to literally a cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty fast. But it's so simple. It's really basic. It's really straightforward. You can get the paper anywhere. Everyone knows how to use it. Yeah,
Now, do they have like a metal filter, or am I only getting paper filters?
There are metal filters. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there are metal filters.
Well, you know, one delightful thing of here, as I'm sure up there, is that like you know, you're in the city, and there's just like there's two like fancy pants coffee shops like a 5 to 8 minute walk from my house, and there's also multiple key shops that just do keys, and occasionally it's crazy. I mean, that's
keys.
A whole nother. Yeah, that's a whole other topic. It's just like super specialized stores, and how do they exist?
Right, I need to make a note of this.
Like I have to imagine the only way they exist is either they sell a metric fuckload of keys so they can pay the rent, or there's some sort of rent control or something, right? Like it's just like there's no, I don't understand, by like American mercantile standards, right? Like, if you have a specialty shop, then you're probably one of 3 to 5 specialty shops in your town, or you're like really expensive. I don't know. It's just weird to be able to like specialize that narrow.
This will have to go in our economics quarter. I have thoughts.
Very good. Well, do you have one last topic to chew over?
No.
Very, excellent.
No. I'm so tired. I'm just absolutely shattered.
Not to be discouraging, but I find myself writing that in my little captain's log all the time. Just tired.
Just tired. Yeah. I have a similar thing where I have to. I'm invited to. Circle a smiley face, sad face, and they cheat. They cheat by not giving you an odd number, so I can't choose the middle one.
Oh, yeah.
So you always have to. I'm forced to voice some sort of opinion, which I'm not happy with.
You need that middle one to be the shruggy emoticon thing.
Yeah,
like that's just like I don't know. I'm pushing the button. Is that anything?
Yeah. I'm clicking.
That's what it would be on your little, you know, like in bathrooms, they'll have the smiley, like, you know, whatever, the same things. And there should be one that's just a picture of someone pushing a button. I'm pushing it.
Push button. Done. Right. Okay. This is not a topic. It's not a small topic, but it is a small, it's not even a recommendation. Mm. It's a small thing I'm prodding at the moment. And it's the Workflow app on iOS, and I am not the sort of person who installs betas because I'm scared of them. And I know that iOS 12 is it now, because Apple bought Workflow the app, and everyone thought they were just going to can it, but they turned it into this thing called Siri Shortcuts, which it turns out is not terrible. And I've been
amazing.
Yeah, it's fantastic, and I've been prodding around with it, and I'm not doing very clever things with it, but clever for me. So when I post things images to Tumblr, I run a workflow that picks up the location information and then puts it in the caption and the hashtags.
And then
puts it in the queue.
Yes.
Really simple, really basic, but it solves a real world like little issue for me.
And you like know Python or something, so you can program it
or something. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I use that for about a year or two to solve my whole dilemma we were talking about earlier, and it was pretty good. I had a whole workflow for it had three parts. It was like post a pin board, it would always do that, and then optionally it would post that to WordPress, you know, in transform stuff, and then all optionally it would post it to Twitter, so you could do the whole thing. Now it was only text posts. I never really got a photo thing hooked up, but like that was like a client side way of solving this problem. I don't know. I guess you could call it cross posting, but I don't know. It was really nice, but it was clunky. parts of it were clunky, and I didn't, you know, the part of like, do you want to do this or not? Like getting user interaction,
branch and take
flows was really weird, but it was nice. Yeah, like I liked it for the stuff you say, where you could like, you could more effortlessly add metadata for things that would be difficult to do otherwise.
They're supposed to be adding it or have added it to the HomePod, so you can trigger, Siri shortcuts, clues in the name, from the HomePod. So it's like, well, okay, this is a bit more interesting, and from the Apple Watch and stuff like that. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, and if it was on the desktop, that would also solve the other dilemma I always had with it is like, this has to be on my phone.
Yes.
But if it was desktop.
That's a good point.
Maybe it would be nicer. Yeah, maybe because then your whole flow is fucked up when you go to your desktop, right? Like you had everything set up on your phone, and that's not always going to work.
Stranded, may I ask you for an Amsterdam-related recommendation, please?
Well, I'm trying to think of an interesting one, but I'll give you just the first one that pops to my head. There's a science museum here called Nemo. Now, like all great science museums nowadays, it's really a children's museum, but whatever, right? And it's a building that's in the I still don't know how to pronounce the main river here. It's spelled capital I capital J.
Yeah.
And I could, you know, whatever. It's a weird name. I think barbarians are involved somewhere. But anyways, it's like in that bay area there, and it's the shape of kind of like a big blue wedge, and the museum is nice. There used to be this exhibit of like pickled dead things in there that I don't think they have anymore, which is great. But the recommendation is you can go on the top of it, and there's a restaurant up there, and it's a really nice view of Amsterdam. And like most all sort of food at institutions in Europe, it's not bad. It's good food. Whereas like, whereas like if you went to go get food in America at a museum, it'd be shitty. You'd be getting like, you know, a hot dog or something.
Yeah. Foam. Yep.
Yes. But you can get all sorts of food up there. So you go up there, have yourself a meal, look at the view. It's nice. It's a good, easy place to go. I'll have to think of some better recommendations. We also went to the zoo, but that's a whole other story.
Have you been to, you must have been to Vondelpark.
We went there this past weekend. That nice. Was nice. Yeah.
Because I the last time I went to Amsterdam was in the last millennium. Mm. So I imagine it's changed somewhat. So I keep thinking maybe I should go back. And I've been to Rotterdam and places like that, but I haven't been to Amsterdam for so long.
Well, Vondelpark is nice. It's just it's just like a park. Oh, and they have there's this other phenomena. I don't know if y'all have it up there, but that is around in Europe where there's like you're in a park and there's like two restaurants in the park.
Yeah.
And for some reason no one's upset about that.
Why would they be?
I don't know. I mean, I have to presume that back in the States people are upset about it because we don't have restaurants in the park, right? Like it's just like there's no, you don't have like, with rare exceptions, you don't have sort of like private industry in the park. It's just like the park has bathrooms if you're lucky, or clean bathrooms. And so it is interesting to just go to a park and like, boom, there's just a restaurant in the middle of the park, which is cool. Like, and so for example, in this, in Vondelpark, there's a restaurant that like the food is actually not very good, but they do sell 36 euro bottles of champagne in a fridge. So,
cool.
You know.
Okay. That's the smallest possible audience.
Yeah, you can find like, you can buy like a little basket of pretty shitty French fries and like, you know, a $40 bottle of champagne, same place.
To wash it down with.
But they have a little restaurant there and there's like a kids park right next to it, which is great. Yeah. Right, yeah, and that kind of find is very rare back home. So that's good stuff.
Yes, I have thoughts about that. We'll have to pick that up again.
Well, good. Well, hopefully, maybe next week we can find some time to record. Always my problem with the scheduling, but we'll sort it out. We'll both be tired. I'll have some tea with the cooker. Yeah. By then, I'll have the Chemex, Here's another fun fact about Amsterdam. While they do not have Amazon Prime in the Netherlands, they have Amazon Prime in Germany, and you get everything overnight. They're just like, fuck it, ship it overnight. None of this 2-day bullshit back in the US.
What do you mean ship it overnight?
So back in the US, if you use Amazon Prime, it's 2-day shipping, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know if you do the calendar math, but it always takes 2 days unless you want to pay $5 to have it next day. Yep. But here, Amazon Prime is next day. So like, I don't know why, but there's no 2-day shipping. It just comes the next day, pretty much.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's
now,
pretty good.
Now that said, if I remember, my Chemex thing doesn't come till Friday, but that was like, you know, special order or something.
Yep.
I don't know.
Yep.
But by next time I'll have that.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, it'll be great. All right.
Cool. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Taking your time, some kindness goes around.